Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Liz Martin.
And this is our report from the SVPCA conference held at Southampton. So, what is SVPCA, Liz?
SVPCA is the Symposium of Vertebrate Paleontology and Comparative Anatomy, which is held every year, normally in the UK. It's kind of an organization of UK paleontologists, specifically vertebrate paleontology, and it kind of jumps around the country, I guess, and there's been a few outside of the UK, but it's typically held within the UK. So this year we held it down in Southampton.
Which is your university, yes?
Yes, it is.
And so were you involved in running this conference?
Yeah, I was very heavily involved in organizing the conference and running it, so that was an interesting experience.
Well, you had practice with the Progressive Paleontology Conference there as well, didn't you?
Yeah, and I was also at almost the same time as SVPCA organizing Flugsaurier, which is the pterosaur conference, the week before in Portsmouth. So it's been a crazy few months.
And so how did you think it went?
I think it went really well, actually. We had the biggest SVPCA ever, the most attendees, and also the largest amount raised for the auction, which goes towards funding students to come to the meetings. So I think it went really well. The feedback's all been very positive. So it was great fun.
Great stuff. And for the Americans and further afield, there's the SVP conference, isn't there?
Yeah, that's coming up in October, I guess.
Yeah.
Right away.
And we should have a report from that too, so look out for that one. But before we get into this, I should first apologise that it's taken so long to get this out. Immediately after recording all of the audio from this conference, I got called off to the oil rigs and I've been there ever since. Only just got back now. So that's why it's taken me so long to do it. I was stuck in the middle of the Norwegian Sea. Which wasn't very much fun, to be honest.
I'd probably much rather be editing SVPCA scripts than
you know
in the
what?
North Sea.
It was more fun, I'm not going to lie. We've got a varied bunch of interviews in this episode on a whole range of topics, so if you like any of those or like any of the people that we talk to, please let us know and perhaps we could get them on to do a full interview. But for now, we hope you enjoy this episode. So the honour of having the first interview here at SVPCA. He's already been on before. It's Dave Hone from Queen Mary University London.
Yep, that's right. Thanks for having me back.
How are you doing, Dave? What have you been up to recently?
I'm good, thank you. I've got a talk here that I've gave yesterday morning, and this was on sexual selection in dinosaurs. So this is an area I've been working on for a number of years with several colleagues, trying to see if there's ways we can actually detect sexual selection and often mutual sexual selection and basically explain some of the ornaments, things like crests, frills, horns, plates, spikes, that we see in dinosaurs and related lineages. And in this case, we're looking at the small dinosaur Protoceratops, which is from the late Cretaceous of Mongolia and northern China. And this is a really great example because actually, unlike some previous efforts that have been done, we've got both very small juveniles right the way through to large adults. We've got a very big range of sizes of animals. There's no issues of distortion on the fossils because they're very well preserved. And we've got a large number of them. There's nearly 40 specimens in the data set. And basically what we're doing is measuring both the length and width of the big frill that comes off the back of the head, and that's just some kind of a shield over the neck. And seeing, does that basically grow faster than isometry? In other words, you know, the animal as it grows will get longer and taller and wider, but is the frill disproportionately growing as the animal reaches full adult size? And this is a key trait for sexually selected characters because it means that this is only being used by the adult. It's something that's not functioning in juveniles, so it's probably not some kind of defense structure, for example, or it's probably not to indicate you know, species identifiers or to keep herds together, because juveniles of this animal we know lived in herds separate from the adults. So if it's to keep the group together, juveniles should have it. And so, yeah, we do show that there is strong positive allometry for both the length and width of the frill, and therefore it's growing disproportionately quick as the animal gets older. This is a classic sexually selected trait, and we're also able to rule out some of these other hypotheses, either because they fail logically, because, for example, they should be used in juveniles or adults, or there's just no strong mechanical support for them. So classic ideas like defense are a bit questionable when this is an animal that's barely 2 meters long and it lived in the same environment as giant tyrannosaurs. It's probably not much of a defense to have 5 mil of bone on the back of your head. And so, yeah, that's what we've put together. It's still preliminary stages, but we do have a manuscript in review, so hopefully there'll be some details out for that soon.
And do you see any kind of sexual dimorphism, differences between the male and the female?
We didn't test that directly. It wasn't something we were looking at, but Protoceratops is actually a classic case of this. Peter Dodson did the first really kind of detailed study of dimorphism in dinosaurs at all in 1976 on Protoceratops. And actually, we used quite a lot of his data in our study. And he recovered a weak but definitive signal of males and females being separate, but actually some more recent studies have challenged that and suggest that actually it's more the usual kind of smear of males and females that are hard to tell apart. So we've just taken them all as a single population.
Why would they put the effort into growing a sexually selected trait, but then not have any difference between sexes? Is that...
Well, that's the classic idea of mutual sexual selection. So it's not just an issue of the classic males competing for females, but actually males want good female partners as well. You often see this in species where there is high male investment. The male is not just trying to get as many females as possible to maximize his reproductive output. If he's contributing a lot of care to the offspring, it's important that he gets a good mate, a good partner as well, and therefore it pays for females to advertise, and therefore you end up with both sexes with some kind of ornament. And this is actually extremely common. Now we're looking for it more and more. We're finding it in more and more species. So there's lots of fish with it known, and actually there's a huge amount of birds with this known. Starlings are perhaps the one that people are most familiar with.
Okay, Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're here now with Gareth Dyke, my supervisor from the University of Southampton. We're going to talk about Romania. So can you tell me a bit about some of the work you're doing in Romania?
Okay. Hello everyone. I've been working in Romania for about 6 years now, since before I came to Southampton, but now involving lots of students from Southampton. We're working in an area of Romania that's close to a city called Cluj-Napoca, which is the second largest city in Romania, about 300 kilometers away in two sedimentary basins that have got lots of fossils, the Transylvanian Basin and the Hatzeg Basin. Very famous in particular, the Hatzeg Basin.
What kind of age are the fossils from there?
These are all late Cretaceous, so it's all almost the top of the Maastrichtian, so almost the very end of the Cretaceous.
And what's the environment like that you get? Is it terrestrial or is it marine?
It's a mixture of both, because these areas all across that part of Europe in the late Cretaceous is thought to have been a series of smallish islands. So the Hatzeg Island in particular is, it's not a small island, it's, you know, several hundred square kilometers, but this island was surrounded by an ocean, so in this area you get sediments that document both marine and the transition between marine and terrestrial, as well as fully terrestrial sediments.
And what sort of fossils do you get in this area?
Well, the Hatzeg Basin has been famous for more than 100 years as one of the best places in Europe, really, for finding late Cretaceous fossil vertebrates. So we've collected, and people have collected in the past, all kinds of dinosaurs, pterosaurs, crocodiles, turtles, even birds are known from these areas.
And of course you mentioned it's an island kind of system.
Yeah.
What things do you get on islands? Like, what is weird or interesting about the islands?
Well, the first person to notice this and the first person to talk about it in the literature is a famous Transylvanian paleontologist called Nopcea, Baron Nopcea, and he was finding fossils in this area, in particular of dinosaurs that are much smaller than their closest relatives. So there are, for example, sauropod dinosaurs, an animal called Majarosaurus, for example, that's about, well, much, much smaller than its closest relatives. And also the hadrosaurs are very small. there's no evidence in this region for any big theropod dinosaurs. So the idea first put forward by Nobcher is that this island system, the animals living on this island system have become dwarfed through their evolution, which is something that he noticed was the case on Mediterranean islands, for example. So in his era, you know, 100 years ago or more, there were still pygmy elephants living on some Mediterranean islands. So the idea was put forward that something called island dwarfism, which is, you know, relatively well-known relatively well-known concept in ecology, that these animals, when they don't have, you know, maybe predators so much, they're living on islands, then they kind of evolve smaller body sizes. And it seems to be true on the Hatzeg and Transylvanian ecosystems.
Are there any big animals at all, or are they all small?
Yeah, this is the other really interesting thing, because on the Hatzeg Island and also in the sediments of the Transylvanian Basin, some of the world's largest pterosaurs are known. Not from great fossils particularly, but an animal called Hatzegopteryx, which may be the largest pterosaur known from anywhere in the world. Maybe because it's known from quite incomplete material, but there certainly were big Asdarchid pterosaurs, which is a group of late Cretaceous pterodactyloid pterosaurs. So these are the pterosaurs with short tails living on these islands at the time. And they definitely had wingspans of up to 10, 11 meters. So we're looking at animals that were the size of small aircraft in their body proportions.
So you said that the material known is quite kind of fragmentary, yeah. And there's not very much. Is that typical of the preservation?
In some of the environments, yeah, it's in some of the sedimentary sections, the preservation is quite spotty. So the bones are very rolled, very weather-worn and so on. So we do have some isolated bones from the skull, from the hind limbs, from the neck, and from the wrist that show that we had giant Asdarchid pterosaurs in these ecosystems. And this animal was named in the early 1990s by Eric Bufteau, who's a French colleague, and some Romanian colleagues as well, in particular Dan Grigorescu, who's the leading Romanian vertebrate paleontologist.
Is it only giant pterosaurs, or do you get some smaller ones as well?
Well, yeah, we've collected over the last few years, friends and colleagues have collected over the last few years, evidence for four or five different size classes of these Asdarchid pterosaurs in these ecosystems. So ranging from individuals that had wingspans of 2 to 3 meters, all the way up to animals like Hatzegopteryx that were 10, 11 meters in wingspan. So yeah, it's a very good place for finding Asdarchid pterosaurs in particular.
And only Asdarchids? No other ones?
Well, we've never, and people working since the time of Nobcher have never found any good evidence for a different group of pterosaurs. But Nobcher, interestingly, did describe some material that he thought was pteranodontid.
Mm.
But that material has never been rediscovered. It's lost. So there has been descriptions of other kinds of pterosaurs. I think that, probably not. This is probably at least Asdarchids were the dominant group of pterosaurs if there was another group present. And that's interesting because these pterosaurs were thought to have been walking around on all fours and maybe using their big long skulls to kind of probe into the sediment. You know, so.
Is that typical of other areas where you get pterosaurs at that point of time, or is it pretty much Asdarchid dominated?
Well, there are some other ecosystems that are Asdarchid dominated, but I think this is unique in that only Asdarchids have so far been collected. And we've got fossils of other groups of vertebrates of all different sizes and all different taxonomic groups. So Hatzeg, for example, there's lots of mammal material that's been collected over the last few years, quite small lizards, frogs and snakes, things like that. So maybe, although pterosaurs have very thin and fragile bones, maybe if they were there, we would have expected to find one by now. So yeah, I don't know.
And just going back to before pterosaurs, you mentioned that pterosaurs are the biggest and most of the other things are small. What about the smaller theropods?
Yeah, there's a really interesting theropod that was collected by a friend called Matyas Vremia a couple of years ago, and this comes from the Transylvanian Basin, and it's one of the best preserved theropods known from Europe. It's called Balor Bondoc, and the Balor name comes from old Romanian, Transylvanian folklore. It's referring to the dragon and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, Balor is interesting. It's a small kind of turkey-sized animal that has two sickle claws on its feet, unlike the normal single sickle claw that you see in other dromaeosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And I say other dromaeosaurs because this animal is probably within that section of the theropod dinosaur tree, a dromaeosaur, or a very close to a dromaeosaur feathered small-bodied animal. So very hard to distinguish it from a bird-like animal if you saw it running around today. And it's the largest theropod that's been collected from this area. There's no evidence over more than 100 years of collecting for anything bigger than that. So this is really unusual.
How big is it?
Balor is the size of a turkey.
Okay.
So rather, you know,
small.
Would come up to your knee, something like that, if you saw it running around. Most late Cretaceous ecosystems, North America, Canada, even in Europe, in places like France, for example, the top predators were theropods, and there's good evidence for, you know, large-bodied tyrannosaurs and things like that dominating the ecosystems. These were the apex predators, if I can use a term from Dave Hone's talk the other day. But in Romania, in Transylvania, in these ecosystems, no evidence for a big theropod. So we have put forward the idea, and, you know, people like Darren Nash and so on have put forward the idea that maybe the top predators in these ecosystems were the big pterosaurs, which is really unusual and makes it unique. So
thanks, Gareth.
Thanks, Liz.
My name is Attila Ösi, and I am from Budapest, Hungary, from the Eötvös Loránd University. I'm a paleontologist working mainly on dinosaurs, pterosaurs, and some other archosaurs also. My project just started more than 15 years ago when we discovered the first dinosaur locality in our small country, in the western part of the country, just close to the Lake Balaton. And this site is late Cretaceous in age, 85 million years old. And we just dug there in the last 15 years and unearthed hundreds and thousands of bones and sometimes skeletons of many interesting animals, including probably some insular dwarf, ornithopods, ankylosaurs, turtles, crocodiles, and most of the typical taxa known from other European sites also.
But dwarf, so they're really, really small.
They are not really, really small, but they are slightly smaller than usually you see in other taxa in Europe. For example, there is a clade Rhabdodontidae that's kind of small, but it ornithopod dinosaurs, closely related to Iguanodon. And this clade is known from Western Europe and also from Eastern part of Europe, from Romania, Austria, and Hungary. And it seems that based on histological studies of my colleague Edina Prondvai, that the taxon what we have in Hungary was the smallest within this group. So it seems that if any of these rhabdodontids were dwarf animals, then the Hungarian one was, pretty sure.
So can you tell us a bit more about the locality?
The site, the locality what we have is a bit interesting because it's not a wasteland somewhere in the countryside, but it was an open pit mine where bauxite, the ore of the aluminium, was mined until 2005 or 2007 or so. And afterwards, the locality, this huge open pit mine, was recultivated, and we had a good relation with the mining company, just to save the site and not to fill it up completely, just to have access to the outcrops, to this Cretaceous bone yielding beds. But 2 years ago, the owner just decided that they have to sell the land for anybody actually who pays. So we had no other choice to buy it. And finally we were lucky because we in the last 10 months our foundation, the Hungarian Dinosaur Foundation, just was able to collect this money, which is how much money was it? I tried to change it. It was a little bit more than 8 million forint. Million Hungarian forints is it's difficult. It's £20,000, I guess.
Okay.
Or so. And with the help of private foundations, companies, and private persons, we could get this money. And now, with two governments or small villages in the neighborhood or foundation owns this locality, and now we can continue excavation in the future.
Did the government not help out and say, we'll give you some money so long as you take school kids around and teach them about dinosaurs or that kind of thing?
Yeah, that would have been a simple solution, as we also thought. But the problem was that the government simply could not give you just money. Just, okay, you can buy it for your company or for your foundation and do it as you wish. The problem was that the government can say, okay, I can pay, and then the locality just goes to a national park or to some kind of state institution. And in this kind of situation, you have no control, at least at the locality. So it could be a bit dangerous, and it could be more complicated officially to organize a field work, to organize visiting of people there and show them that that's the locality and these are the dinosaurs what we have. So I think the best and easiest way to do what we want to do is using a foundation and organize everything throughout this foundation.
And so you got the money, and now you've got your own dinosaur-yielding quarry. What are you going to do with it?
We just want to continue excavation. We want to make some kind of dino park or something, you know, just for fun, for to show for the people how a locality look like, how the sediment look like. You know, this dino... how to say this, the feeling of people and the thinking of people on dinosaurs, which is traditional and very well known in the western part of Europe, in England or in the States or in Canada, because there are dinosaurs in the last, unearthed in the last 150 years. This was almost unknown until the last few years in Hungary. So there was no dinosaurs, just only footprints from the southern parts of the country. But, you know, the knowledge about dinosaurs, it was almost zero in this country. So we have to build a kind of new knowledge that these animals lived also here in this part of the continent. These are 85 million years. And this is very, very important just to popularize not only the dinosaur research and vertebrate paleontology, but earth sciences also. So this is the distant goal of our foundation and our projects, besides research and fieldwork, to popularize this kind of studies and work for the popular community.
Well, best of luck with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's always nice to catch up on things going on in my hometown of Manchester. So I found Elspeth Wallace, who has just finished her undergrad at the University of Manchester, and she's been looking at crocodilian tooth morphology from the Hell Creek Formation in America.
Yep, absolutely. So what I've got here is kind of trying to find a more numerical way of identifying teeth instead of basically saying, oh, this looks like this, or this looks like this, or I found it in a drawer so I can definitely say what it is. So what we did was we firstly tried to look at the curvature of the teeth and kind of measure the angle of curvature, but as you can see from our R squared value of 0.3, it didn't really work out for us. So then we looked at just the general morphology, so the height, the labiolingual depth, and proximal distal width, and that gave us a much better result. So we plotted our data on a triangular diagram, and we've got lovely groupings for Borealosuchus and Brachychampsa, less so for Therakosaurus, but it's still a good result to be able to see that we have got the groupings for those two species, and a method of, well, measurement could be used to help identify these species in the future, possibly.
Okay, so
you've got your different tooth morphologies all grouping together for your different species. So you can say that this tooth is from this species because of its shape, generally.
Yeah.
So what can you say about the shape of the teeth? Can you infer anything about their feeding strategy from them?
Okay, well, for Brachychampsa, I'd say yes, definitely. Especially towards the posterior of the dentary. You've got these lovely, well, in the literature they're called button-shaped teeth, but they're just basically very squat, flat, really robust teeth that would definitely not crack if, say, the animal tried to bite down on something shelly, whereas the long, pointy, thin teeth of Thoracosaurus or Borrelia suchus probably would. So from this, we can probably say that Brachychampsa was more of a shell-eating crocodile, and I've even read papers that have claimed it was a turtle-eating crocodile, but until I see a turtle with a bite mark out of it, I'm less likely to want to believe that. But for Thoracosaurus and Borrelia suchus, because their teeth are so similar, you can't really infer anything about feeding strategy from that. But by looking at their skulls, you can start to, because like modern gharials are piscivorous, and they've got a lovely long, thin snout capable of opening, closing quickly underwater and catching fish, which is very similar to the snout of a Thoracosaurus. Whereas Borrelia suchus, that species of skull, it's a lot more robust, it's shorter, fatter, much more capable of grabbing onto something outside of the water, dragging it under, drowning it and eating it that way, which is similar to kind of like alligators of the modern day. So it needs a lot more research, but I could make tentative conclusions about that and possible niche partitioning, because we did find them in a very geographically like close area. So perhaps they were niche partitioning in this way.
And speaking about more research, what are you going to do? You're going to continue on your path to becoming a paleontologist?
Hopefully. I'm doing an MPhil next year at Manchester, so hopefully we'll be taking this a bit further, and you might see me next year.
Are you going to stay with crocodiles?
I think so. Yeah, we might branch out a little bit, but for the moment, I'm going to stick with crocodiles. Yeah, my first love.
When you consider a skeleton, perhaps one of the bones that you'd overlook is the patella. But Sophie Regnault is here, and she's got a poster looking about the evolutionary history of the patella in mammals. So can you tell us a bit about what the patella is? Why is it different from all the other bones?
Yeah, sure. So basically it's your kneecap. And as you said, most people tend to neglect their kneecap. And in fact, that's true in science as well. They're quite neglected structures. No one's really that interested in them. Maybe the kneecap is the sexiest of all of the sesamoid bones, and these are basically just bones that will develop in a tendon. They're not, you know, directly jointed onto any other bone. They just grow in the tendon, and they're thought to increase the distance to the joint, so they give the muscle a bit of extra leverage. So we're looking at the kneecap as a sort of very well-known and familiar and very large sesamoid bone, and we're trying to see when it's evolved exactly in history and see whether that would give us some clues as to what it's doing. So it's interesting because it's evolved independently in birds, lizards and mammals, and so we wanted to see, well, maybe if it's evolved three times independently in these groups, maybe it's evolved within each of these lineages multiple times as well. So we've taken a zoom in closer look at mammals and tried to reconstruct the evolution. Oh dear.
Thank you.
So tried to reconstruct the evolution by basically seeing which mammals have it and which don't, and that was easy enough for the stuff that's still living, but maybe a bit tougher in the fossils. So how do you prove something that's missing its kneecap? Maybe that's just someone's lost it somewhere along the way. But we've tried to do that as reliably as we can, and then used a kind of computer algorithm to work out over the evolutionary tree what's the most likely pattern of evolution. And we've come up with maybe between 5 to 8 or 9 evolutions of the patella within mammals. So it looks actually like maybe mammals have come up with it several times independent from each other.
Wow. So other than the leverage of tendons, is there kind of any other benefits that you'd get from having a patella?
So people have thought maybe it protects the tendon, so sesamoids seem to form in parts of the tendon that are being bent around other bony structures, so around your knee or around your fingers and toes. It maybe is protecting that bit of tendon from being compressed. The main hypothesis is that it's increasing the leverage, and that perhaps maybe as you're bringing your legs more underneath your body, that mechanical advantage gives you more benefit. So if you've got your legs sprawled out to the side, it doesn't matter so much that you're not getting this huge mechanical benefit. Maybe, we're not too sure. We're hoping to maybe go on to do some modelling experiments to try and prove that is the case. But then the other possibility is that very early on it wasn't doing anything at all. It's just maybe a byproduct of physiology or ossification or just the tendon's reaction to forces within it. But then later on throughout evolution, it then provided an advantage and then became this bigger structure. So that's another thing that we're hoping to look into.
So plenty more to come from kneecaps in the future.
Yes, I've got another 2 years of my PhD, so I'm hoping to have a lot more to look into.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
And with me now is Mike Taylor from Associate Researcher at the University of Bristol.
Or I may be a Research Associate. I can never remember which.
And you had a talk on sauropods, didn't you?
Yes, all my talks are on sauropods, actually. But this one was trying to figure out what apatosaurines were doing with their very distinctive necks.
And what kind of evidence can you draw upon to work that kind of thing out? I mean, surely it's just the neck, isn't it? It helps them reach up high places.
Well, as so often with sauropods, in fact, always the case, pretty much all we have is bones. There are very few sauropods where there are skin impressions, but that's the only other evidence. So in figuring out these necks, we're just looking at the bones of the neck, the cervical vertebrae. And the thing that's really bizarre about apatosaurine sauropods, that's Brontosaurus, Apatosaurus, and one or two close relatives, is that all the way through the evolution from the base of where birds diverge from crocodiles and coming down through the birth of the dinosaurs and down into sauropodomorphs is this constant trend of lengthening and lightening the neck. And then when you get to the apatosaurines, they do the opposite. The necks suddenly get much, much, much thicker and heavier. So that's what we were trying to understand.
And so what do we think that thickening could be?
Well, the shape of the apatosaurine vertebrae is really odd. So the central line of a vertebra, it's where you can think of it as being the axis of the neck. It goes through a part of the vertebra called the centrum, and then above that is the neural arch, which covers the canal that the main nerve goes through. And then out to the side of the vertebra, in most sauropods, you have two processes called the parapophysis and diapophysis, and they meet and support a rib, a neck rib, which we call a cervical rib. And the really bizarre thing about the apatosaurines is that both of these things, the parapophysis and the diapophysis, are both super thick and robust, and they hang way, way downwards below the centrum. So instead of being at the bottom of the vertebra, as it usually is, the centrum is more or less in the middle, and then you've got the neural arch on top and the cervical ribs way, way below. So what that means is if you look at one of these vertebrae from the front, it's basically triangular. So the apatosaurine neck, instead of being a long, thin tube, the way it's often drawn in paleo art, actually would have been more like a gigantic fat Toblerone.
Other Swiss mountain-based chocolates are available.
There was a Toblerone slide in the talk. I don't know if you missed it.
Oh, I missed it. I wasn't here. But
I had one with an apatosaur head on the front of a tube of Smarties, and then that was crossed out and replaced with a Toblerone.
So we've got our Toblerone necks. What were they doing with it?
Well, we don't know for sure. But what we've done is a team of four of us. It's led by Matt Wadle from Western University of Health Sciences in California. There's me, there's Darren Naish from the University of Southampton, and a paleo artist called Brian Eng. And we've been batting it around between the four of us. And what we think is, just looking at the bone evidence alone, here are the things we observe. First of all, the way those cervical ribs are far below the centrum means that the vertebrae are well constructed for resisting impacts coming up from below. Secondly, it means that the muscles that move the neck downwards will have been attached to those cervical ribs far, far below the mechanical axis of the neck, which means they will have been very powerful for pulling the neck down, maybe in a powerful strike or just a strong push. The third thing is, because of these cervical ribs hanging down very far from the sides, very deeply down, there'll have been a sort of inverted V of soft tissue underneath the centrum. Now that's usually the vulnerable part of the neck. It's where you've got the arteries and the nerves and the windpipe and everything else. But in apatosaurs, all of that would have been safely cushioned and wrapped up in muscles and air sacs and all sorts of other soft tissue. And the last thing we noticed is that on the front of those cervical ribs, pointing downwards, slightly outwards, slightly forwards, there are distinct bony knobs. They look like sort of clubs, which you don't really see in any other sauropod. So when you put it all together, what we concluded is that the neck can be brought down very strongly. It's very well shielded against impacts on the underside, and it has these bony clubs sticking out from the bottom of the neck. We think that probably what's happening is the apatosauruses and brontosauruses were fighting against each other, probably males, as usual, fighting to impress females who, as we know, they're very shallow, very impressed by that kind of thing. I'm speaking of female apatosaurs, not female humans. So we think these are combat adaptations because they're so different from what we see everywhere else across the whole sauropod family tree. And what perhaps makes it even more exciting is that these bony clubs, when we see things like this in extant animals, things like the bony knob on the front of the skull of a rhinoceros, usually they're the base for some other kind of structure built on top, so like the keratinous horn of a rhinoceros. It may well be that at the bottom of each of the cervical vertebrae of an apatosaurus, we had something a bit like a rhino horn pointing downwards, slightly outwards, that would have been involved in the combat. So there are lots of different styles of combat that could have been going on there. Elephant seals today, when they fight, they do it by rearing up against each other and just pushing the fronts of their bodies and their necks against each other, and it's a test of strength. So the apatosaurs might have been doing that. It might have been something more violent, maybe trying to hit each other's necks, trying to get one neck above the other to bring down and get a strike with those horns on the underside. It could have been more like a wrestling match. There's really no way to know. And of course, because there are quite a few different species of apatosaur, it's quite possible that they had different behaviours.
So this kind of behaviour, I think, initially of giraffes, they hit heads with each other using the necks and stuff like that. Is there any kind of similarity between the necks of the two?
No, it's actually hugely different. And the reason is giraffes, being mammals, have very heavy, highly fused skulls, which make pretty good weapons. But apatosaurs, like all sauropods, had extremely fragile skulls. So an apatosaur that whacked its head into an opponent would just crush its own skull. So they would definitely avoid doing what giraffes do. It would have been neck-to-neck combat rather than head-to-neck or head-to-torso.
And thinking of the characters that you described, the ability to move the head forcefully and the spikes on the neck, they sound like adaptations that would be advantageous for everyday life, sort of. It could be protection from something trying to bite its neck, or it could use its muscles for moving that head around everywhere. So how can you rule those out?
Well, I think an animal that evolves a structure for one reason may well use it for others. So it's now mostly thought, for example, that the horns of Triceratops are primarily a sexual display. But you can bet that a Triceratops being attacked by a Tyrannosaur wouldn't just lie down meekly, but would use those horns, whatever their original evolutionary purpose was. So in the same way, even if we're right that the very thick triangular apatosaurine neck evolved as a form of sexual display in combat, I'm sure it would have been used for other reasons as well. But I think we can be fairly confident that the things like predator defense weren't the principal reason that that neck evolved that way. And the reason is because if that's what you needed to protect against predators, you would think a lot of other sauropods would have done the same thing. But it really is only that one tiny group.
Okay, Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are a few things more attractive than a giant shark. And here at the post-session, David Ward has a new giant species of thresher shark. Can you tell us about...
I'll do my best. Thresher sharks are pretty common in the fossil record, particularly in the Miocene. And in the 1940s, a very large one was found and described by La Riche. It was, I think he called it something like Salopius grandis, showing a degree of imagination. But what he missed was that in the sediments a little bit younger, in the early Miocene, there was a serrated form, which was even larger. And this shark was probably double or treble the size of a modern thrasher. And, say, being serrated, it probably had a lifestyle very, very similar to a great white, except it was considerably bigger than a modern great white. And we only have the teeth, and they only have a few of the teeth. I think we've probably less than 100 teeth known. But very few of them show wear facets, damage to their tips. And the strong likelihood is this was a hunter killer of other big sharks, and the obvious one that it possibly went for would be the giant Carcharodon, Carcharocles, or Atodus, whatever you tend to call it, Megalodon, the giant megatooth shark that inhabited the Miocene. So
this was the Megalodon killer.
Almost certainly, yes.
Wow.
Which its serrated cusps were ideally designed for, or evolved for, shall we say.
So if we've just got isolated teeth, do sharks have a lot of different sizes of teeth in their mouth at any one time, or are they all round about the same size?
Yeah, they're all more or less around the same size. They tend to be a bit bigger in the front, and they become lower and wider towards the edges of the jaw, commissures. But the problem with shark's teeth is that a shark will produce so many teeth, something like perhaps 30,000 in a lifetime. The shark is growing, the teeth are being produced continually and shed, so the teeth are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and you tend to have differences in, say, where they are in the jaw and which jaw they're in, and whether sometimes they're male or female. So it's almost a small miracle if you find two that look the same, unlike a mammal tooth, where if you get a canine, you get something that has a discrete size. Shark's teeth aren't like that, which means their study is a lot more complicated.
So we've got our giant shark Megalodon, we've got now the giant thresher shark, the Megalodon killer. So what was going on at this time? Why have we got so many giant sharks?
Well, I think that's probably down to the oceanographic productivity, which in the late part of the early Miocene into the middle Miocene was tremendous. Wherever you look worldwide, you get gigantism in some of the top predators, and a radiation in some cases of the predators. And it's to say, it's normal for the time. You sort of expect everything in the Miocene to be enormous, and they are. But finding this was a big surprise, because it's very unusual to come across the remains of an animal that's going to be 6 or 7 meters long in a time slot and a formation that has been collected for the last 150 years.
And so, do you think we'll get any bigger?
No.
Well, there we go then. Thank you.
Thank you.
So Sarah Strachan from the University of Southampton has a poster on the histology of the ankylosaur pelvic shield. Can you tell us a bit about ankylosaurs?
Yes, so ankylosaurs are characterised by their extensive dermal armour. So they're the quadrupedal herbivores, and they have, you know, spikes. And the specimen I'm looking at has a pelvic shield over the ilium and sacrum. So that's what I've been looking at. I've been looking at the histology, which means I've taken a thin section of that structure down through the pelvic shield, through, there's a sediment layer below, with some connective tissue, hypertrophic cartilage, which is really interesting, and you can see the cellular structure preserved. And then underneath that, you've got the ilium. So this is a dermal ulna, so it's formed by metaplasia, which is transformation of the cells, direct transformation of the cells. And it's particularly interesting because we haven't got many of these specimens. They're quite rare. This particular one is from the Isle of Wight, and it's amazing. It's 70% complete. It's on exhibit at the moment on loan to the Sea City Museum. And we've got long bones, articular end of long bones, we've got spikes, we've got the pelvic shield, we've got some ribs, sacrum, no skull, unfortunately. And it's not unusual, you know, it's would be very rare to find that, which also makes it a challenge to work out what species it is, because much of the phylogeny is based on morphology of the skull.
Okay, it sounds, you say that it's rare to get something that's 70% complete, but you mentioned that it's got cells preserved. Isn't that a lot rarer?
I was very happy to find that. So sandwiched between the pelvic shield and the ilium beneath is a layer of sediment and a layer about 1 centimetre thick. And we've seen that before in many of these other pelvic shields. But what's really unusual is preserved here is a layer of a section of connective tissue. And these beautiful sort of... this cellular structure, sort of rectilinear cellular structure, which we've interpreted as hypertrophic cartilage, and pretty sure that's what it is. And you can see them, these beautiful chains of cells. So that's some sort of supportive connective tissue layer between the bone of the pelvic shield and the bone of the ilium.
So can we tell anything about how the ankylosaur was able to grow its pelvic shield from looking at its cross-section?
Not really. I'm not sure. So this particular structure, as with the osteoderms and the spikes, we think would probably have grown by metaplasia, so direct transformation of a soft cell, as opposed to, for example, the ilium, which is a flat bone, which would grow by sort of periosteal accretion. So it does grow in a different way. What's also interesting within that structure, within the pelvic shield, is a very unusual, very complex network of structural collagen fibres. So, and I can see in some of my slides actual individual collagen fibres, and they're wound together in bundles. And then that makes a sort of three-dimensional network within the bone itself. I don't think that makes it sort of flexible or floppy, but it would probably add toughness, and it's certainly a very interesting structure. And sometimes we can use that network itself to be phylogenetically informative. So overall, we would love to have more specimens to compare to. There isn't that much material. Our thoughts at the moment are that it's some sort of possibly a different species of Polacanthus, that the structural fibre bundle arrangement seems to be unique. It's unlike current description, so that's interesting. And of course, these wonderful, this cellular structure preserved underneath the pelvic shield is very exciting.
Okay, thank you.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.